from KQED. From KQED in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Penny Nelson, in for Michael Krasny, who's on vacation. Texas Congressman Michael McCaul spends much of his time in Washington focusing on matters of security. He chairs the U.S. House of Representatives Committee on Homeland Security and co-chairs the Congressional Cybersecurity Caucus. He has a new book just released presenting scenarios of ways the U.S. could be attacked. The book is called Failures of Imagination, The Deadliest Threats to Our Homeland and How to Thwart Them. We'll discuss the book and a whole lot more in the hour ahead on Forum. Stay with us. From KQED in San Francisco, this is Forum. Good morning. I'm Penny Nelson, in for Michael Krasny, who's on vacation. My guest is author and six-term U.S. Representative Michael McCaul, and he's not lacking in imagination. In fact, in his book, Failures of Imagination, The Deadliest Threat to Our Homeland and How to Thwart Them, he presents a wide range of elaborately constructed scenarios that present what he suggests are plausible major attacks on the homeland. McCaul then offers ideas about how such an attack might be thwarted. The Texas congressman knows a bit about that which he speaks. He's a chairman at the U.S. House of Representatives Committee on Homeland Security, and he also co-chairs the Congressional Cybersecurity Caucus. And because of these roles, McCaul is privy to frequent security briefings and is likely familiar with near-miss attacks that the rest of us go along blissfully unaware of. This hour on Forum, we'll talk about the current state of security here in the homeland, Congressman McCaul's assessment of how the Obama administration has managed the threat of and actual acts of terrorism, and we'll look ahead to the next possible president and how ripe that candidate's imagination might be given the threats to the homeland in the future. We'll, of course, also discuss the book. Well, I wanted to start, if I could, Representative McCaul, with some news of the day. We've got many things going on. First, let's talk about the prisoner swap, the hostage swap, whatever you want to call it, that went on between Iran and the U.S. of five Americans coming over in exchange for an Iranian. What do you think of all that?
Well, Penny, thanks for having me on your show. First, I'm very pleased our hostages have come home. And that was, you know, when I talked to Secretary Kerry, I also serve on the Foreign Affairs Committee, talked to him about, you know, could this be a part of the Iranian negotiations? Obviously, I guess in the back scenes, it was discussed, obviously. And now they were coming home. That's a great news. What's not so great, in my opinion, though, are seven essentially Iranians that have been involved in providing military assistance to Iran in violation of federal law and U.S. International law as well. There are also 14 sort of at-large Iranians that are not have basically been given a clemency or been pardoned, two of which we believe may have been involved in the bombing in Argentina of the Jewish center down there. And
these are the Iranians that were sent back over.
Correct. And so there's seven were swapped out. Mm-hmm. They were actually had been indicted in our federal system and have been now sent back to Iran. There are 14 at large, though, that have been given clemency, two of which we believe were involved in the Jewish center bombing in Argentina. And so, you know, that concerns me in terms of, you know, terrorism in general. I think the whole concern I also have as chairman of Homeland Security is the amount of money and the lifting of the sanctions, about $150 billion, being really propping up the Ayatollah regime and the largest state sponsor of terror. What will they do with that new found money?
Okay, so now you're talking about the deal, the nuclear deal.
Now I'm going back to
deal.
The deal, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So when it comes to the – but let's stay with the hostage swap just for a minute, because I want to – in as much as we can, when we come back to all of these points, looping back into your book, if the idea is to anticipate and thwart acts of aggression, you know, every one of these things that we might talk about. So say there's a prisoner swap, and we don't want to have a failure of imagination in any situation. So is this an example of weakness or a lack of imagination as to something that might happen? Because my understanding is that the prisoners that were swapped, the Iranians that were swapped, did not have terrorist necessarily intentions or ties or activities in their past. And so let's stay just for a minute on the swap. That's something that has met with some criticism. Did you find it a move that was problematic? Did you find it something that was, I mean, obviously we want to see our own Americans come home, but let's stay with that as a potential threat, not a threat, a worry, a good political move. What do you think?
Well, I think, you know, it depends from your vantage point. I think that, you know, I think the president, President Obama's, as I understand his directive was, do not release any violent or terrorist Iranians. And so the ones that there's one out of, you know, Houston, for instance, but they were involved in providing military assistance to Iran, which prior to the negotiations and the deal would violate. Actually, it violates federal law today, but this was part of the prisoner swap. And I guess the fundamental objection I would have is that it's swapping hostages taken in Iran that were not criminal in any way with criminal Iranians that have been under, you know, a U.S. attorney has indicted and charged them. And so now we're, we gave them pardons and we're sending them back to Iran. Do I see that as a, as a threat? Well, I mean, if the 14 at large, if the two out there that may have been involved in the bombing in Argentina of the Jewish center, I mean, that gives me some pause. I think the bigger picture here is the amount of money being lifted with the sanctions and what that means long-term. And, you know, the idea that the Ayatollah now has been sort of reinforced in Iran and has been stabilized as a leader. I was a very a strong proponent of the Green Party in Iran, which was sort of the revolution, the younger revolutionary political force in Iran that I think had had potential at one point in time to overthrow the theocracy and the Ayatollah. That was not supported by, I think, the president because he wanted this deal to happen. And now I think now that the deal has gone forward, it really takes the Green Party in Iran, their ability to conduct a revolution like that almost completely off the table now.
What about the idea that winning the hearts and minds of the Iranian populace might improve relations over the long haul, which would make America safer?
Well, yeah, I've been a big proponent of trying to westernize or to the extent we can, you know, share with them our ideas and change the hearts and minds. Of course. I mean, I don't think most people living in Iran actually like the conditions under which they live. It's a very, it's a theocracy, a dictatorship. It's very, you know, sort of religious driven. And they take away a lot of freedoms in Iran. And I think the more, yeah, I've always advocated, you know, we got to drop 20, you know, hundreds of thousands of iPhones with Western music, right, into Iran and let them listen to our culture. And I think you would find that a lot of the younger generation would very much be drawn by that. I think music could have a great agenda in terms of winning the hearts and minds in the radicalized world, which I actually had a bill that passed out of foreign affairs. It's called Peace Through Music, where, you know, we talk about that issue, where music could transform this really sort of part of the world that's not very modern, you know? I mean, they've gone back centuries.
Well, in Tehran, I think in Tehran, you got a lot of music and a lot of westernization kind of de facto on the streets and with the young people, very educated young people.
Correct. But it's a violation. I mean, it's illegal.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, and one other sort of newsy, and then I want to talk a little bit about the Super Bowl as well. But as far as I know, there's another thing that with your with the security Committee, looking at the strength of ISIS and whether or not the forces and the warfare of ISIS, if one can call it that, is growing in strength or being depleted in strength, that there was some discrepancies in what the Pentagon and what the U.S. military was assessing as their strength. There was perhaps a question about whether or not there was some manipulation of information going on, and you established a task force. Can you explain better than I am what that situation was and where the task force is in that?
Yeah, and we we produced a task force report that was a bipartisan report on my committee, signed off both sides of the aisle, because I honestly don't think the terrorists check your political credentials. They don't really care what party affiliation you have. And so it was a bipartisan task force. We looked at the issue of foreign fighters and also countering violent extremism within the United States as well. But we found that the flow of foreign fighters has increased exponentially, 20 to 25 to 30,000. Now 35,000 foreign fighters have come into the region, which would be what they call the caliphate in Iraq and Syria.
Have come into what region?
Iraq and Syria, the Islamic State.
Okay.
So now we have 35,000 from 120 different countries that have come into this part of the world to fight, to join the fight. And we I'm concerned about those numbers increasing. In addition, where bin Laden was very much in primitive communication mode with Kays and couriers, you have a new phenomenon, a new generation of terrorists, if you will, that have gone viral, that use the internet to their advantage through social media. I think one of the biggest concerns we have is about the idea that they can radicalize people in the United States over the internet. We have these internet communications coming out of Raqqa, Syria. There are about 200,000 tweets per day that have really two messages: come to Syria or kill where you are. And when it's kill where you are, it's usually military or police. And that's a very difficult challenge for federal law enforcement, who I deal with a lot, and as chairman of Homeland Security, trying to deal with that threat. There's also the threat of the foreign fighter, which is what we saw in Paris. Paris attack was basically foreign fighters, eight of them, with about 20 co-conspirators that were able to pull off a very sophisticated terrorist attack that was very lethal. I don't want to see that happen in San Francisco. I don't want to see it happen in New York. And if I could just finally end with this, their communication has gotten so sophisticated that now they know how to speak in what's called dark space. And I know a lot of our viewers are very educated and high tech, and you know, I chair the high tech caucus as well. And I'm from Austin, so it's a high tech center as well. But it's encryption, and they have apps on their iPhones. We know the Paris attackers used one called Telegram to communicate in darkness, and that's why we didn't see it coming. Most of these things we've stopped. We've been very fortunate, but it's the ones that you can't stop. And if we can't see their communications, it's hard to stop it. And even if we have a court order, probable cause and a court order, we still can't see this dark space.
Where do you stand? Here you are in the middle of Silicon Valley, essentially. Where do you stand on the backdoor controversy and all of this being able to access people's devices?
Well, I've been a proponent against a knee-jerk legislative response to put a backdoor in everybody's iPhone. I think initially, interestingly, the FBI Director Comey and Secretary of Homeland Security Jay Johnson, who came to San Francisco, spoke at the RSA conference, talked about how we need to amend this law enforcement statute to include smartphones. But the problem with that is it would put a backdoor into everybody's iPhone, which means not only can the government get access to your phone, but also so could hackers. I think there's a technology solution to this. I'm a friend of Silicon Valley, but I'm also I work very closely with federal law enforcement. Senator Warner, a Democrat out of Virginia, and I just proposed this idea that was reported in the Washington Post in an op-ed about forming a commission to put together the top minds from Silicon Valley, from federal law enforcement, from the intelligence community, to privacy advocates, to find a technology solution to this problem. It's an urgent problem because it is one of the bigger threats that I see. And it's in one of the chapters of my book. It's one of the threat scenarios.
It's hard to believe that with all the mental juice out there that there isn't a way to do it. I mean, I have to believe there's a way to do it. And I just my skeptical brain doesn't believe that there's not a way that this can be done.
I think there is. And look, members of Congress aren't going to have the brains to do it. I'll be honest with you. Like, it's going to come from the experts in the technology field and from, people from the intelligence community and from federal law enforcement to get to the right place. Right now, they won't even sit down and talk to each other. And this commission would force them to sit down together, come up with a solution rather than a knee-jerk response that puts a backdoor in everybody's iPhone. I think that would have tremendous blowback. And not only that, Penny, but half of these, more than 50% of these apps or encryption applications and technology companies are overseas. So it wouldn't matter. We could pass a law tomorrow, but we're not going to have jurisdiction over the very apps that the terrorists use. And if I could just end with one other point, and that is that this is now going beyond terrorism. Now criminals have sort of gotten into this game where you have drug cartels, narcotic cases, child pornographers, all understanding that they can communicate in encryption in a dark space, and they know that they can't. That can't be. There's no light that can be shined on it.
All right. Well, and one other news topic, and then we will get to your book. The Super Bowl is upon us very shortly. The 50th Super Bowl, big event, and it's happening right down the road in Santa Clara. Levi Stadium, and it's going to be a doozy. Now, if there was ever a moment when we needed to have a lot of imagination, because that's a big event, this is the time. A couple of things that have kind of been floating around as potential problems at the Super Bowl is something to do with the fiber optics. And I don't know, you know, you're not from the area, so it's probably not on your front burner, but the federal officials are looking at whether there might be an attack on the fiber optic system and whether cutting cables to the fiber optic system might end up being one of the plots that might take place. Let me just ask you, without getting into the specifics of that, what in the world of terrorism would be the good of that?
Well, there's a chapter in my book about cybersecurity, and it is you know, we talk a lot about ISIS and we focus on Al-Qaeda a great deal. But the fact is a cyber event could have far more devastating consequences to it. So I look at this particular case, and as chairman of Homeland Security, I do coordinate with federal, state, and locals on the Super Bowl because it is the largest sporting event of the year. We do know that sporting events are a target. Just look at Paris and the soccer stadium, what they try to do there. With suicide bombers. And so that's the kind of thing we're trying to protect against at this event. A cyber attack on a fiber optic cable could essentially shut down and put the entire stadium in darkness and in chaos. And so, we want to make sure they're protected both from a cyber intrusion, but also a physical cutting of the cables themselves, which would cause a similar effect.
And maybe a practice run, maybe that sort of thing, to see how much breadth they get, or I don't know, how much distance, how much space, how much, I don't know.
Well, we had a power station where they physically, in California, where they physically tried to take it out with machine guns, and they caused a lot of damage physically. So,
right.
So yeah, big sporting events are always a target for the terrorists, so we're always very well prepared.
Talking this hour with Congressman Michael McCaul, Republican from Texas. He serves as chairman of the U.S. House of Representatives Homeland Security Committee and is also a member of the Committee on Foreign Affairs and is founder and co-chair of the Congressional Cybersecurity Caucus and also on the High Tech Caucus. He has a new book out called Failures of Imagination, The Deadliest Threats to Our Homeland and How to Thwart Them. And we're looking for your calls. The number to call is 866-733-6777. 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or you can email us at forum@kqed.org. And we're going to get to the book here shortly. We've been tackling a bit of news because there's so much going on. But Failures of Imagination has scenarios of possible attacks. And let me tell you, there's no failure of imagination in these scenarios. It's like reading a whole bunch of thrillers and or watching Homeland, binge watching Homeland one episode after another. So we'll probably in the second half of the show be tackling most of it. But I do want to ask you before we go to a break at the bottom of the hour, why Failures of Imagination as a title when that's the last thing that we're talking about?
Well, it's what the 9/11 Commission referred to after basically saying that 9/11 was a result of a failure of imagination. I think imagination is powerful. And if we don't have an imagination to foresee what could happen in the future, we can't stop those threats in the future. In fact, after 9/11, I know they actually brought in Hollywood producers to sort of, you know, get together and try to figure out what else could they possibly be doing, because we didn't anticipate that airplanes would be used as cruise missiles. We did anticipate hijacking, but not a cruise missile scenario. And so I think it's important to use your imagination in my business. You know, I deal with these things every day. I know the average listener and reader does not. And what I want to try to do is educate the American people as to what I think the real threats are and what we need to do to stop them in a constructive way.
Is it hubris on the part of the U.S. in that we just didn't believe it could happen here?
Well, we didn't think Pearl Harbor could happen either, and it did. And we always think the oceans protect us and the continents, you know, we're too far away. And that's always been, you know, that theory has always been disproven. They can attack, particularly now when it has with the global internet age that we live in. We're very vulnerable to that. And we're seeing not only ISIS and Al-Qaeda manipulate that, there are chapters in my book, but North Korea, the Sony attacks in California, shutting down free speech and knocking out, completely destroying all the hard drives there, to China, espionage, stealing $20 million of our security clearances, including my own, by the way, and Putin's aggression.
All right. Well, we're going to take a short break at the bottom of the hour here, and we've got a nice full bank of calls, but looking for a few more. If you want to join in the conversation, 866-733-6786, or email us at forum@kqed.org. And we'll be talking about all these different scenarios that Congressman McCaul presents in his book, Failures of Imagination. And it's quite a number of stories, and frankly, it's a little scary, so I want to hear how he thinks we might have been able to thwart these. I'm Penny Nelson. This is Forum, and we'll be back after a short break. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Penny Nelson, in for Michael Krasny, who is on vacation. And speaking this hour with Michael McCaul, he's author of a new book that is called Failures of Imagination. And it's tackling various threats, scenarios that could happen in the U.S., and then ideas on how those challenges, those threats, those dangers, those terrorist attacks might have been thwarted. And Congressman Michael McCaul is on several security committees in the U.S. Congress and heads up the U.S. Committee on Security. Tell me again.
Homeland Security.
Thank you. And we would like to go right to some of our calls because we've got a lot of them. Prafulla in Cupertino, join us.
Hi, my name is Prafulla. So I have a question to Senator McCaul. He was talking about the radicalization from using various means on the internet. I was just curious to know what kind of steps have the federal authorities have taken to make sure, you know, like completely block the tweets from offensive tweets from areas like Raqqa and Iraq and Syria, wherever these fighters are posting it from, or maybe even Facebook posts. Because
wait, Prafulla, I'm not sure I understood that last sentence. To block what?
block offensive tweets or Facebook posts.
Oh, I see. Blocking offensive tweets and posts.
Because there is no question of jurisdiction here. So I was just curious to know what steps have Congress taken, if there is a requirement for bipartisan bill or something, or maybe even what steps the federal authorities have taken.
Okay, let me put that to Congressman McCaul.
Well, that's an excellent question. I mean, currently, we have a lot of restrictions in terms of U.S. persons, but overseas we can look at these 200,000 tweets per day. But you can imagine the volume and chatter is so high, it's hard to get a handle on all this and stop everything. We've had 80 ISIS-related arrests in this country already because we've been able to monitor some of these communications. But your idea of offensively blocking obviously it's something that the United States military is looking at. I think it's an option on the table. We always have to be a little bit careful with our cyber offensive capability, and I have to be a little bit careful about what I say publicly. We have tremendous capability in that area, but when you do that, you also would also offensively take out larger swaths of the entire country of Syria, which will cause unintended consequences as well. A more targeted cyber attack would obviously be the better way to go. We do know there are internet cafes at Araqqa that send these messages out into the United States and all over the world. And the question is how best to stop those communications from happening. In the physical world, obviously we have drone strikes that we have used. Junaid Hussein was a top cyber commander for ISIS who sent out tweets to the Garland terrorist. In fact, he was the number one guy behind the New York July 4th plot and many other plots out there and arrests that we've made in this country. Junaid Hussein was taken out by a drone strike. But an offensive cyber operation is a little bit controversial, a little bit complicated, but it's certainly an option on the table that we're looking at.
All right. Thanks for that call. I've got a couple of emails in here. Layla writes, has your guest ever been to Iran? Even though music is illegal, Tehran has the newest music from Europe as well as the U.S., the newest fashions and the newest books all underground. So to think that the young Persians are ignorant of music is ignorant of your guest. It's not the lack of music, but the abundance of torture that's keeping those young people under the thumb of the government.
Well, I think that's, I wouldn't say I'm ignorant, but I would say that, I think that, I'm not allowed to go to Iran. I've been to Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan. I've been all around Iran, Saudi Arabia. I've been in the Middle East quite a bit, and I've seen the culture and understand it. I agree with the caller that it's the oppression. It's the oppression of the younger generation in a theocratic, dictatorship. And it is the torture that takes place that I do object to. And one of the objections I have about the deal is that it just reinforces the Ayatollah's capability and stability to be in power for a much longer period of time.
Andrew writes, I'm sorry, but I disagree with your guest about the need to westernize that region. Of course, groups of people are going to be resistant to stronger world governments actively trying to change the culture within their borders. I think first the U.S. needs to do a better job of understanding that the culture of the Middle East, understanding the culture in the Middle East and adapting our strategies to that. And Robert writes, more than 30,000 Americans die each year, largely owing to easy access to guns. Many more are injured with life-changing results. Why is the daily mayhem not considered the greatest threat to homeland security? And, Representative McCaul, that's actually a point that lots of people have made in lots of different shows, that homeland security and guns, they're never joined as an issue. And it's true, it's not an external threat, but in as much as homeland security is an issue and guns are an issue, Where do those meet?
Well, I think there is an intersection there. I mean, obviously, we see a lot of documented cases, terrorist cases, where they got access to guns. And that's obviously a combination you don't want to see. I think we also, in a lot of these cases, we obviously have a mental health crisis in this nation. that we need to deal with. There is legislation that I've co-sponsored in the Congress to ensure that people who have been mentally adjudicated mentally defective are put into the database, into the system. When I met with the New York Police Department just recently, they told me about 50% of these cases of people who've been adjudicated mentally defective have not been put into a database as required. And you know, that would block the purchase of firearms of people that shouldn't have them in the first place, like the Navy Yard shooter. He had been adjudicated mentally defective, and yet he was able to purchase a firearm. And so in a lot of these what they call homegrown violent extremist cases, what you find there is maybe a little different from the foreign fighter, jihadist trained, but rather someone who's been radicalized, who's vulnerable and gets radicalized over the internet, who may have mental health issues and just wants to be a part of something greater than themselves.
Right. But I think a lot of people feel like if we put as much energy and panic into a lone wolf or whatever you want to call it, a single shooter who happens to not be foreign born, but has a gun and is American and just shoots. If it was treated like Homeland Security, if it was treated like terrorism, you know, that it might have some weight on the whole gun debate. But I don't want to shift our conversation to this.
You know, the one question on Western, what I meant was this is a struggle of ideology, radical Islamist thinking, which perverts the religion. And it's an ideology. You know, we're going to have this struggle. It's generational. And it's not modernized. It's taking things back in time. And I think what I meant by that was the ideology that I think our ideas win and prevail at the end of the day. But the ideology of ISIS is a very backwards, barbaric ideology. And so I think the more they can modernize, not necessarily become American or Jeffersonian democracy, but rather just be able to modernize is what I meant by that comment.
All right. Let's go to Will, who's calling from Hayward.
How you doing? Thanks for having me.
Good.
My question is for the senator. Do you feel that a national concealed carry reciprocity act that's going around in the Senate right now would benefit if a homegrown terrorist decided to do a domestic attack?
Well, I guess we're going to talk about a lot about guns today. But, you know, in my state, that was passed. And it's actually kind of an experiment. I mean, to see if a terrorist event occurs, if the average citizen who is carrying could respond to that threat rather than wait for law enforcement. So San Bernardino, probably a good example. I mean, I suppose if people at that Christmas party had holiday party had weapons, they could have responded to that. But, you know, I think you're going to see states experiment with this and see if it works.
All right, moving on. Thanks for that call. Let's go to Dan in San Bruno. Hi, Dan.
Hello. Yes, I had a question about the vulnerability of nuclear power plants as a terrorist target.
All right.
I would say that's probably the thing that's most secure. Unlike most of our critical infrastructures, nuclear power plants are completely taken off the internet. So they... If you're not, you know, everything, the United States is so tied to the internet, that makes us more vulnerable. The one thing that's not tied to the internet in the United States are our nuclear power plants. We have a lot of physical security around them as well. I think what I'm more worried about are the nuclear devices in countries like, say, Pakistan, which do have the nuclear capability that could be stolen and then brought into this country.
All right. Thanks for that call as well. Let's talk a little bit about some of the scenarios that are in your book. You do one that I found very, very frightening and interesting was the smallpox scenario. And it takes place in Disneyland or Disney World, one of those places. You know, we had after... We have had little mini panics, I think, at different times about bioterrorism that take hold and then they sort of disappear. But that's one of those scenarios that is really insidious and frightening and the potential to sneak up on us. And talk a little bit about, let's not talk about the ways in which it can be activated, because I think we all have imaginations. But talk about ways in which we might, as a nation, be more effective in our protecting ourselves or potentially thwarting something like that.
Well, and the reason I chose, in each of the chapters, a certain name, this is a bioterror example. And I picked smallpox because smallpox killed 300 million people. And we are inoculated globally to that. But there are countries that hold the virus that if let out of the bottle could infect huge populations. And the reason we picked Disney World was not to cause panic, but rather that's a place where people from all over the world come to. And then they go back. And so, you know, it was after the Ebola virus hit that prompted me to write this chapter, because I saw the terror that really struck in ordinary citizens, because it's really the threat you can't see. You don't know where it is. It's not like a kinetic attack or a bomb or a gun, but rather you don't know if the person next to you on the airplane has it, or, you know, the person you go to school with or whatever. And smallpox, we have stockpiles in the country. We want to make sure that we have enough to respond to a crisis, but it would happen so quickly that it would be very lethal to a lot of Americans. There was a dark winter exercise done after 9/11, and it's in my chapter in the book that talks about how quickly this could multiply throughout the country and the world with a very lethal force. We want to make sure that it was, you know, basically the bio experiments done in Russia and the United States. We had our own bio weapons program. So did Russia. Our treaty shut that down. But a lot of the Russian bio weapons, we're not sure where some of these biological threats are today. And we're concerned that some of them may have been leaked out of Russia.
One of the callers writes in or tweets in, what's your solution to Gitmo? I'm sorry, Guantanamo Bay.
To Guantanamo, I don't think bringing in what's left there now. We're approaching under 100 now, or really the worst of the worst. I've been down there. I saw Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the perpetrator of 9/11. And it was a very spooky experience. I just don't think we ought to bring them in the United States. I think they would create meccas for the jihadists. We already know they want to attack military installations through their internet communications. If we brought them to a military prison in the United States, in my judgment, it would just serve to be contribute to more acts of terrorism in the United States against those facilities in the United States that would hold them.
It would be a draw.
A magnet.
Maybe, mm-hmm. And maybe of interest for martyrdom?
Of course. I mean, right. You already saw the attack in Chattanooga, which was an attack against a military recruitment center. Imagine if Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is at a military prison like Leavenworth, the idea that this would be a magnet for acts of terrorism.
So what is a president to do? This will likely now move on to whoever is next. There's no winning. There's no winning.
Yeah, it's not an ideal situation. I personally think that they need to move forward with the military prosecutions, which have been stalled. If some of these have been determined not to be a threat, they've been released. We do know that some of them have returned to the battlefield and have killed Americans and others. So there's no easy solution to Guantanamo. I know that's part of the president's narrative, that he wants to close it down. I do anticipate that even though in our National Defense Authorization Bill, we prohibit the bringing in of these prisoners into the United States, I anticipate an executive order that will come down in the near future to close down Guantanamo.
All right. Well, it seems like there's no good answer, because this president hasn't really been allowed to move forward on it. On the other hand, there's no place for him, there's no way for him to move forward, because there's no place that will accept them. And I don't know what the next president will do, because it doesn't look like the scenario is going to change. Let's go to Jerry, who's calling from Vallejo. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. My question is this. For people that, like the ones that call themselves the Islamic State, for them to function and survive as they are, they need to recruit, heavily recruit, because they take losses, they have more territory to maintain. And where they recruit, the main recruit is young, unemployed people. What are we doing to get at that base and remove that possibility for them?
Yeah. Well, look, it's a you know, how do they radicalize people in the United States as well? They prey on vulnerable people. I think you look at the average foreign fighter, it's a military age male that comes from 120 different countries. And I would say, you know, unlike Al Qaeda, which actually was very sophisticated, you had a lot of trained physicians and academics. The average ISIS foreign fighter is not that well educated and typically does come from a more impoverished area. I would argue, you know, after the Arab Spring, what we found were these power vacuums that popped up in northern Africa, like Libya, for instance, all throughout northern Africa, Yemen, places in Indonesia, and, of course, the Middle East and Iraq and Syria that have contributed to this. Anytime you have a vacuum of power, that vacuum is typically filled by the terrorists. And they do prey on a younger male that comes from more sort of impoverished conditions. So I think you have to look at this from a holistic standpoint. Everybody says just push a button militarily and the whole thing's over. It's very naive. There should be a military strategy, but there's got to be a political and diplomatic solution as well as an economic solution.
Here's, a very interesting email saying, why can't our government... I think it's a little provocative, but why can't our government unleash the hacking world onto terrorist sites, known terrorist sites, and shut them down?
Well, without getting into the classified space, we do have great capabilities. And so I think and we can do that. They are very adept at moving on to the next Twitter handle to the next one, from one device to the next.
But we've got to be better.
No, we have to be better, and we have to evolve, and that's what my book's about, is evolving in front of the threat. But, the Paris attackers changed out SIM cards, changed out iPhones, and they can set up sites and move on to the next one. But the caller raises an interesting idea that I have had discussions at high levels about why can't we just go in and stop this. And, I think it's getting to the point, honestly, Penny, where the volume is so high that is one of the options that I think is under serious consideration.
Well, and he goes on to write, it's a simpler solution than implementing a backdoor even. You know, we have all this techno power and all, there's, as do the, lots of folks. There's a lot of folks who are our allies to get moving on this.
So, and that's a technology solution that, we're looking at technology solutions rather than legislative that have unintended consequences. And I think caller raises a good point.
Okay, let's move on a little bit. We only have about, 5-10 minutes left. Let's move into the uncharted territory of the 2016 elections.
Great.
Because why not? Have you endorsed anybody?
No, I have not.
Are you going to?
I don't really have any plans. I'm sort of like Switzerland right now.
But you're in San Francisco. it's forward thinking.
I think,
if not here, where?
I will say this is one of the most unpredictable, craziest presidential elections I've seen in my lifetime. And I don't have a crystal ball. What I want is a commander in chief, somebody that understands the world that I talk about in my book, and somebody that can bring a little more order to the chaos that's out there. My dad was a World War II generation veteran, was part of the air campaign, the D-Day invasion. And, we became a superpower, and I think we need to lead as a superpower. We need to engage the world, not retreat and become isolationist. I think our foreign policy should be that way as well. So I'm looking at a leader that has those qualities that can – whoever it is going to inherit quite a mess. And I'm not saying that – you can argue that was caused by Bush, and you can argue it's caused by Obama. And I think there's probably enough blame to go around, on both sides. But the fact is there are a lot of hot spots in the world right now and a lot of threats.
All right. I'm asking you then, as chairman of the House Committee on Homeland Security, who do you want? You don't have to endorse, but give me a few people who you would feel comfortable sitting in that Oval Office with the threats that we are facing. Who does not lack imagination?
Well, again, I'm not picking and choosing right at this point, so I'm not going to get in. I'll say there are a few that I think have the sort of background from a national security standpoint that I'm looking at. I'm going to support of course my nominee. I do think I don't know if Mrs. Clinton's going to be the nominee on the Democrat side. She has her strengths and weaknesses. I mean, I would say her weaknesses were, how she did respond to the Arab Spring and what happened in Iraq. And she went to Baghdad one day for 3 hours to meet with the prime minister of Iraq. And now no status of forces agreement like we had after World War II. It imploded. And now AQI, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, has become ISIS. And now we have to deal with this threat, even though we don't like it. And we want to put our head in the sand and pretend like it doesn't exist. You have to deal with reality. And that's the point of my book is I'm giving the American people a true and honest representation of what the real threats are.
Then let me ask you this way. We've got a set crew of candidates. Of that crew of candidates, do you feel confident that we will have a president that can handle what we are looking at as far as potential aggression against the U.S.?
I think, I've intentionally stayed out of the race for a variety of reasons. I think whoever it is going to need some top advisors because, it's too complex right now, the world and the problems out there. I don't think any of them have 100% of the skill sets. They're going to need some really good advisors.
That is a very diplomatic answer to my question, because that was the answer to my question. I want to end by putting a quote to you, because I think it's powerful and it's all I could think about when I was reading the book. FDR said, "We have nothing to fear but fear itself." And I think we live in a very fear-inducing time. And I honestly think our politicians, all of them, are stoking fear in the American people. We have a lot of fear-mongering going on. And we have it in the press. It's everywhere. So what is that doing to the American people?
Well, one thing I try to do is be responsible in my rhetoric, because I get the briefings and I get the classified stuff, and I try to be responsible. I see other either presidential candidates, or I see, members of Congress go on television and become very inflammatory, or say, for instance, there are ISIS camps in Mexico and things that aren't factually accurate. And I'm always factually accurate, but I do think the threats are real too.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being with us. That's Representative Michael McCaul. Would you say that you agree that this is a fear-stoking time?
I think it's a fearful time. And that's not the purpose of my book, as I say. It's not to induce fear. It's to provoke imagination and deal with how can we stop these things from happening.
Do you think there's a way to empower people so they don't have so much – people live in such a state of fear right now?
Well, I think it's because you don't know where it's going to happen next. If it happened in San Bernardino, where they said it can never happen, the JTTF was not focused on San Bernardino or Chattanooga. I think that's the brilliance of the terror and the terrorist, is to say it could happen next door and you don't know where it's going to happen. So, but we can't give in to that. Otherwise, we lose, right?
I was going to say, then the terrorists have won.
And we don't want them to win. So I don't think that's the right attitude. I think we prevail at the end of the day. I end my chapter with looking at the House of Abraham and the three religions that came out of there, and how it's not going to happen in my lifetime or maybe my kids, but hopefully one day the three religions can peacefully coexist together.
All right. Once again, that's Representative Michael McCaul, and he will be tonight at the Commonwealth Club. That's tonight at 6:30 p.m. So if you want to hear more or see the book, get the book, have the book signed. I'm sure that will be an option there. So the Commonwealth Club tonight at 6:30 p.m. Well, thanks so much for being with us again.
Thanks, Penny.
Thanks to the callers and the people that came in. The book is called Failures of Imagination, and very interesting reading, and no lack of imagination there. Forum's produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Lorberg. And our engineer this hour is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, and we get online support from David Marks. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. And stay with us for the 10 o'clock hour for special coverage of the governor's State of the State address. And the California Report will follow that up with some analysis with Scott Schaefer. I'm Penny Nelson in for Michael Krasny, and you are listening to KQED Public Radio.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegas Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.